This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Loreen Roy. She's a professor and graduate advisor at the School of Information at the University of Texas at Austin. And she was the former president of the American Indian Library Association and the American Library Association. Loreen, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be involved. Thank you for inviting me.
I've been doing interviews the last few years with the ALA presidential candidates as they lead up to it, and I had the current president, Sari Feldman, on recently, but you're the first past president that I've had on the show. So I was wondering if you can, ALA president, obviously I'm talking about, can you talk about what the experience was like as a whole, sort of now looking back on it? Like, it's been, what, about 8 years since you were ALA president? How does that sort of sit in your memory as an experience?
Well, thank you for remembering that. You know, there is a gathering at ALA annual and ALA midwinter. There's a dinner, and they just call it the dinner for the has-beens. And so, you know, once that year is over, and as you exit being past president, it all does just become a memory, I think. Although people do, a lot of past presidents do transition to other aspects of service for ALA. I was fortunate to serve as president of the American Library Association. I was 125th president, and the first, people still introduce me as a past president sometimes, and often will say, oh, this is Loreen Roy. She was the first American Indian president of the American Library Association. And I do recall many things about that year. I served in 2007-2008 as ALA president. It was a busy year. I was also still employed, and I did have support for one reduced teach load during one semester. So I did have a little bit of a lighter schedule during the spring, January to May 2008. But you know, there are things that you attend to as ALA president. You are the spokesperson for the organization, and so you respond to requests related to the routine activities. You make appointments when you're ALA president-elect. You chair council. You chair the ALA executive board, the ALA executive committee, for example. You respond to events or occasions or discussions as they arise. So you're sort of on call. It reminded me a lot of my early career working in hospitals. I was what they now would call a medical imager. So you're sort of always on call. You respond to media requests. And then you try to attend also to the promises you made as a candidate. And especially if you identified action areas that you want to devote some time and attention to. So it's a busy time. You don't get paid salary, you know, during that time other than your salary from your employer. You have a lot of responsibilities you learn to juggle. And I recommend it for anyone, actually. I think it is a very exciting and fulfilling time.
And do you think I know everybody kind of has their, like you said, you have your own themes that you kind of came up with as a candidate. Do you feel you were able to follow through on everything that you had wanted to do as a candidate?
Well, I think I spread my ideas. They're very broad. And Sarah Long, actually, about, oh gosh, was maybe 89, 90? No. When was she ALA president? It was the late 90s. Like maybe it was 98, 99. She was the last ALA president to actually have an official theme, Libraries Build Communities. And then afterwards, we were candidates and elected ALA president-elects, we're told, you know, you don't really have a particular theme, but it doesn't mean you can't devote time to focusing on topics that interest you. I had several. One was looking at the role of practice within LIS education, so service learning. And we had some discussions. We had forums, educational forums, that luckily Joe Sanchez, who was then a doctoral student in our School of Information here at the University of Texas at Austin, he coordinated those for me. And then a year later, when I was ALA past president, immediate past president, two students and I edited a book on that topic. So that's how we addressed that aspect. I was very interested in services for, and continue to be, services for Native youth, Indigenous youth. And so we tried to draw attention to that through programs. And then again, a year later, I was included in an active partner in an activity called Operation Teen Book Drop with Reader Girls. And through their contacts with publishers, we were able to deliver a free book to 10,000 Native teens through their tribal school libraries. So we addressed that interest, and that continues to be a contact area for me. That was a one-off event. I was interested in wellness issues, and that continues to be of interest to me, a wellness for our library workers. And in fact, this year in 2016 at our Texas Library Association annual conference, I'll be on a panel for wellness workers or wellness in our field, and including my wonderful orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Barbara Bergen, who gives a terrific talk on how to avoid maladies that she sees. She treats a lot of library workers, a lot of librarians in her practice, and how to avoid getting these maladies and acquiring these problems. And then if you do have them, how to treat them. So, the ALA president year, the presidential year, allowed me to explore and to listen and to hopefully start some things and to see where the interest was and to move on from there. There was one action, one activity that has received a fair amount of attention in certain circles since I was ALA president. And it was sort of a side thought. I was, as ALA president, and you've probably learned from some of your other interviews, you do travel to represent the organization. And I was in China, and I had just visited a wonderful public library. And I thought, of all our ALA members, they would love to know what is happening here. And I would love to be able to recognize those library workers who created this wonderful setting. So I contacted Michael Dowling, head of the ALA's international office, and just said, is there some way I can recognize this library? And he said, as long as you don't call out an award, you can do what you like. So I started some recognitions for international innovation in librarianship. And now that's become a regular feature of the international reception at ALA. And for the recipients receive a little piece of paper. It's now managed very well by the International Relations Roundtable. And library workers from around the world come to ALA annual to get a framed certificate. And so I never thought that's what would happen with that recognition thought. But ALA staff, Deline Guerra at the international office, really keep that going. They have a committee, and people are very, very grateful for that. So that's very heartwarming to see that one thought becomes tangible.
Well, you were talking about wellness, and it makes me think that a lot of times as librarians, sort of we're focused on, helping our community out, but that's really helping ourselves out. I mean, it's helping our internal community out to provide what they need. So it's nice.
Yeah. In fact, that was a little bit of the sticky point in talking about wellness. I received a lot of emails from people saying, oh, we love this topic. Our patrons will love it. I go, this is for you. And
right.
That I think in the workplace, it impacts all of us, but we don't talk a lot about it to, maybe on Facebook and to people who know us, but to how do you manage in the workplace with injuries, with chronic situations, with, I remember I talked something about weight control. I said, yeah, I can do it because I could use it. And I had somebody contact me and say, you really have to say that if you're overweight, you're still fine. And I said, no, that's not what I want to say, and And so the wellness aspects, you know, I was concerned that our wonderful library workers should and can continue through their careers feeling well and into their retirement feeling better. And so it's still an issue that interests me a great deal. Again, I had an early career working in hospitals, and we here at the University of Texas Austin, we have a medical school starting next fall. I think it's the first medical school at a university. I don't know, was it? I hear different quotes, whether it's 20 years, 25, 40 years, but it's very important here. And we're just focusing more right now locally on aspects related to wellness and informatics, medical issues.
Well, as you said, when you were talking in your first answer that you're American Indian, but the field itself is obviously still overwhelmingly white. And I think I even saw recently that it's the whiteness has gone up recently. What do you think that library schools and ALA and just everyday librarians can do to help encourage more diversity in the profession?
Oh, that is a really great question. And it is something that we voice support for. And, you know, I think, what is it, 84, 87%, maybe more now, you know, there is an ALA survey of membership that comes out. And we see, if you think of I think it's the average librarian is a woman in her 50s who is Anglo.
Right.
And there have been initiatives that provide support for students from underrepresented groups to enter into our programs. And I think those have been wonderful. They're wonderful to watch. You know, the Spectrum Initiative is known by within the field. I don't know how many prospective students hear about it. I did a little study of the first 5 years of the Spectrum Scholars. It's posted somewhere on the ALA office, the Diversity and Outreach Office's website. But I looked at different topics such as mentorship. And we have a notion of mentoring being, you know, lifelong. Someone takes you under their arm and guides you, and you meet with that person. It can be formalized, but it's very contact-centered. And I learned from hearing the stories of these first 5 years of Spectrum Scholars that a mentor can be someone who just sort of pops into one's vision or periphery for a very short time, but someone who leaves a message. And a number of the Spectrum Scholars mentioned that they didn't even know someone they worked with, but the person handed them a piece of paper and said, you should look into this. And it was information about the Spectrum of scholarships. And it took that message, but it also took initiative on that prospective student's part to say, look, I will look into that. So we have some financial support through Spectrum. We have some initiatives at schools of information, and Knowledge River has been sustained. A lot of these are grant supported. I had one from the very first round of the Laura Bush 21st Century Awards for a program here called Honoring Generations. And I was able to provide support to 7 Indigenous students who have, many of them have, they've done wonderfully in the field. And in fact, I'm going to Rob Yazzie's birthday party tomorrow here in Austin. And he was the first of those students. So we have funding issues for Native students. Native people are overrepresented in degrees from 2-year degree granting institutions. So, for example, community colleges and especially tribal colleges. But it's getting that bachelor's is a big issue, and they need that bachelor's to apply for a master's program. And for many students, it would be the online program would be their option. So I think it's up to all of us to continue to bring awareness to the field, to students from the very young age and throughout their careers, help support them in various ways, and show them what you do in your work that is fabulous and that would interest them. There are, you know, wonderful aspects of the field, from the day-to-day interaction with patrons to focus on technology to the ability to go to terrific supportive conferences, to writing, to meeting people who are important to you day to day and those who are our rock stars, our authors. And so it is a good field. It is a wonderful life experience, but we need to be able to be inclusive and support those who we feel should be able to join us and would represent the communities that they serve.
What do you think some of the, sort of on the same, on the similar topic, some of the unique challenges that librarians face who are trying to work with indigenous cultures, either in the tribal schools or in public libraries in indigenous areas? I know I've read some stuff that you had written or talked about before of sometimes there are some suspicions of the white Western culture kind of coming in and trying to impose themselves on them. Can you talk a little bit about that, of some challenges that might be hard to get into that those schools and those particular libraries?
Well, in terms of libraries that serve Native peoples, of course, there are Native people everywhere.
Right.
And so you have 2/3 who live off reservation areas. And so they're in all public schools. If you have 10 Native kids, and in this way, they're defined by having a grandparent who's identified as Native person, then a public school system can apply for a grant and if they have a parent organization, like a little parent group, they can apply for a grant to help those students focus on their Native culture and become more aware of it or engage in activities. And so the Native kids, Native parents, Native patrons are everywhere. And this is a result, of course, of various reasons why people move. And especially for Native people, the federal policy during the 50s was relocation and termination. There was a strong desire among in our federal government to terminate tribal relationships and reservations, and some were. And then along with that was the great encouragement to move to urban areas where jobs and housing was promised, although that didn't happen. But then once moved there, Native people stayed. So there are large populations in urban centers, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Denver, Chicago, just as a couple of examples. So serving Native people, any school, any library, any community may have Native clientele. For the Native kids and their families who are on tribal lands, they might receive their library services through a community library. They might receive library services to a tribal school library or another school that they're attending. And then there are the tribal college libraries, most of which are west of the Mississippi River. Those librarians have a gathering every June, usually at Montana State University. This has been going on for over 20 years. Marianne Hansen and Gary McCone are the two coordinators currently. Marianne, longstanding coordinator. And it is a wonderful opportunity for those librarians and library staff workers from the tribal colleges to get together. But half of that community are Native and half not. And those folks have worked long in those communities, lived there. And so they are attuned to the responsibilities they have to their communities and also what it's like to work with Native people. Sometimes you have someone, and I still get approached by people who say, I've always wanted to work with Native people. How do I start to go about this? And then I ask people to really look at the motives. It's great to get help, but consider what is the motivation. Of course, if you're Native, you've heard all of the stereotypes. People think of Native people in certain ways, and we're human like everybody else. We're known for our senses of humor. We do have our inside jokes and a strong connection to what our beings are and our connections to our cultural communities. And it doesn't mean that non-Native people aren't welcome, but you do want to consider, what the motivation is and also the protocols. And protocol is a word you kind of associate with, like, military installations. But for Native people, there's a common understanding of protocol is the way you behave. And it's politeness. It can vary some from tribal community to tribal community. So being attuned to how do I behave in this setting? Do I feel comfortable introducing myself by my family connections? what questions do I ask and what questions should I not ask? So it's there's some sensitivity required, but it doesn't mean that Native people aren't willing to share and don't welcome people interested in their lives and their histories and their presence. You know, a common question and comment you hear is that people believe that Native people aren't alive again. I think that's the most common question and comment heard at the National Museum American Indian, where they overhear teachers and museum visitors saying, well, these are all artifacts of people who aren't alive anymore, but we are very much alive and very present and in many ways growing even more so. And we have, you know, there are still active discussions about related issues. One that just came up over the last 2 days, and I think it was Parents Magazine had on the cover a photograph, and I think it was related to an article in the magazine, How to Handle Your Child When He or She Has a Tantrum. I think it was to do with that. And maybe you saw references to this. And the child was dressed in one of these little fake headdresses, implying that, you know, if a child who has a tantrum is sort of subhuman and Natives are subhuman, and using stereotypes. And of course, some of our strong women in the field who monitor what's going on in children's literature, especially Debbie Reese, responded. And I read some of the replies last night on the Parents Magazine website. The nasty replies to her comments saying, this is not polite. And there, I couldn't read anymore. I said, I don't know why I'm even dipping into this, where it kept me up hours. And I said, no, I'm not going to reply. I know what happens next.
Yeah, I mean, when you see that, I mean, it plays exactly into the savages stereotype thing, and it's just, yeah. And from what I saw, the Parent Magazine put out an apology or something, but that's all they've done so far. And again, the less said about, I think, internet comment sections.
right. I just read some, you know, and that's yesterday. That's the day before. This is not in the old days. I think it was about 4 years ago. I was at a conference in Houston, and I was helping moderate a film screening. It may have been in 2008, 2009, so maybe a little bit longer than that. And I was asked to go by WGBH Boston, and I was with somebody else working on promoting this television series on Native peoples, We Shall Remain. And I was told to go get a badge so I could walk through the exhibits for this conference. And the woman who told they couldn't find my badge. I said, can you tell me where I should go for the badge? Do they have moderators' badges in a certain area? And she looked at me and she said, oh, the badges for the squaws are over there. And looked at her and I said, you know what you just said to me? And later in the exhibit, she came over to me. She says, I know what I said to you. She says, I had a boyfriend who was Native. I knew exactly what I was saying to you. And I said, why did you do it? You know, and so it's something that is every day. And I think people of color know this. You know, this is every day. And I think that's why when I walk across my campus, and if a Black student looks at me, they give me the nod. And I give, you know, it's sort of like recognizing, okay, keep going. We don't know what's going on with you today. It's probably a good day for you, but we know that things sometimes happen.
Well, in ways that not just diversity that we're hoping to expand more, but the profession, obviously, beyond that, is just changing a lot with technology and everything else too. How well do you think, as a library school professor, how well do you think library schools are doing at keeping pace with changing to keep up with the way the profession is changing in all these different ways?
That's an interesting question. I've thought a lot about that topic this fall. I'm in a school of information here at the University of Texas, Austin. We're a face-to-face program. And so our student population is a little bit younger. And they're mobile. They can come here to Austin. And like other schools nationally, and I've heard internationally, enrollment is down a little bit. We're pretty steady, but we're a little bit down. And looking at the students, and I taught one of our required classes this fall, which is they call a core class. And there recently was a survey of our students, what they think of the core. And there's always are always comments we share with our career services person. We learn from her. Our students want to learn to do right now. And this reminds me greatly, and I tell the students, I go, you are like the students from 100 years ago. I spent, as a doctoral student, I spent time writing a few papers, historical papers, on students who were in the Illinois Library School from 1897 to 1912. And I'm hearing now very similar comments. Students during that time wanted to learn to do. This was the era of what D. Garrison called the tender technocrats. Young women primarily, it was then also feminized, young women who wanted to learn the skills to go into small communities where no librarian had ever been, or to work a little bit later for H.W. Wilson Company and become an indexer, though that was the Facebook and Google of its day, and to renovate something, to start something, to do things in the right way, and to have the skills to do so. And those skills were cataloging. Those skills were learning to use a particular typewriter. Those skills were library hands, so they knew the penmanship to use on those catalog cards. And I see something very similar now. Students want to learn to code. And teach us to code, coding in every class. They want to learn how to create databases. They want the skills in HCI. They want the user experience label. And it's all very good. And it's hard for sometimes to convince them that they also need the values. They also need to have that foundation that's going to sustain them longer than the next version of whatever new software will emerge. So you help them with the flexibility. And you help them by saying, you know, I don't know that, but you can teach each other. You can help each other. Last 10 minutes of this core class that finished just a week ago, I asked students to write on a little slip of paper, and I have this little tin can we use in class to draw slips of paper out of the numbers. I said, write something that you want to learn here in the program over the next 2 years you're here. And we drew some of the examples, and I just used them as examples of what some of their classmates wanted to learn. I want to learn how to use a citation manual. I want to learn how to program and how to code. I want to learn how to teach a library instruction session. And I said, all of this exists here. It does exist here in your courses, but more importantly, in each other, so that the person sitting next to you, the person on the other side of the room, other side of the column, those are the people you can and should be able to rely on over the next 2 years. So we know that they have the flexibility, the motivation to learn, to continue to learn. And it's really hard to keep up with them. It's hard to keep the work that I do in classes sound and be relevant, and also to learn along with them. I never get to graduate. They're the ones who go on. And it's a sort of an odd version of the movie Groundhog Day. They come back, but hopefully that things I do improve, and I try always. But, you know, whatever you do, the students have, it's hard to impress and to say, you know, I am trying to keep up with you guys, and you're teaching me too. So, yeah, they have great needs. They're going to do fine. And our students are terrific, and our graduates do wonderful things. And I trust that's what happens in the other programs as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, you don't get to graduate, but you just get to keep learning over and over again. So,
class returns, it's an interesting time.
So you talked about that UT is a face-to-face program. Do you see that, what kind of value do you see in that as opposed to an online program? What does that kind of give you that an online program can't?
I have taught one fully online class for the University of Hawaii at Manoa. I've been fortunate to teach three times for UH Manoa during summers. And twice I was there 3 weeks and didn't go to the beach. You know, it's very intense. And then the third time I said, well, let's stretch it out. Let's do it at a distance. I wanted that experience, but I also wanted to compare what that experience was like to having the students in a group face to face. But here at UT Austin, again, we do face-to-face classes. Our students, may and sometimes apply to and be accepted into certain courses offered through WISE, W-I-S-E, at our online classes. So the face-to-face classes, they're both very valuable, golden time that, you know, we have the time to see each other, but they also, there's a lot of attention to class management, course management, and I was talking to one of my colleagues, Karen Wickett, last week. She says, you know, she talked about all the work she put into her syllabus and getting everything organized. And then you meet people and then you deal with people, you know. So it's, you know, how to behave in class. If you take an online class, even when I taught it, you can be in your pajamas. You can be eating if it's not live. You can be, have your cell phone out. You're in a class where everyone sees you, and I recently went up to a student. I saw texting when she should have been working with a group. I could tell she was smiling into her cell phone, and I do have a policy that we don't do that. And I said, please put it away. Group needs you. We have a break coming up, and that's a good time unless it's an emergency to do that. So you spend a lot of time on that personal maturation type of advice. We always need to work more to help them on group projects, presentations, a lot of advice. I give them a lot of advice on presentation skills, as do my colleagues. And you get to know them. I'm very particular about reference letters. I need to have a student not only complete a class with me, but work with me in some way outside of class. So I know the students very, very well, those I work with, and know them through a lifetime. Yesterday, Laura Schwartz, our Fine Arts Library director, was celebrated at her going away party, and she's moving to San Diego, and she said, 20 years ago, you gave that reference letter for me that got me this place, you know, and so that's wonderful, you having a comment back from a student. Of course, Laura got herself that job, but, feel I know the students well, and that's an advantage of face-to-face. They do learn to work with each other or have to, but especially in the library instruction class, I have to incorporate, I'm working more to incorporate this spring, information about serving people, you know, the distance learner, the person who you might not ever see face-to-face. And in the basic reference class, the students also participate in the Bill Pardue's Slam the Boards activity, where they go online and answer questions from the public, people they'll never meet. So they need to have that experience as well.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the online is good because obviously you can reach more people. But yeah, I went to a face-to-face program specifically so I could have that class interaction. And it can be important. But yeah, obviously, I mean, it's not everybody can be somewhere where there's a library school, especially as the library schools have shrunk in number.
And it's, you know, for me, I would always love to have native students in this environment. And unless I have funding to support them here, so even the move, and, you know, I don't have as many native students as I would really, really like to see. Right. So, you know, what I support and believe in, sometimes I can't act on.
Well, you're working on a project that looks at how libraries serve veterans. Can you talk about that project?
Oh, thanks for asking about that. Yes, we're wrapping up the report. And this wasn't a census. This wasn't to identify all cases of how libraries serve veterans, but it was to identify some cases with learning outcomes. And so I have a preliminary report. I'm working on finalizing it. And I think part of my motivation for this is personal. My dad was a veteran of the Korean War. And if you are involved in Native communities at all, you know that Native people respect the veteran experience. And regardless of what you think of the motivations of that, of having conflict and combat, you respect the person who steps up, and there's always been overrepresentation of Native people and support for, like, through selling of bonds from talking about early wars. I'm finishing reading a book on Native veterans in the Civil War, and a lot of things I never knew that so early. So I'm interested in the place of veterans, and of course, how we as information providers can meet and support their needs. We're finding, and we found a wide range of ways to support veterans. And from the, I would say, the least complicated and the more traditional, building a collection. We have resources on X, to libraries that have dedicated staff, like San Antonio Public Library has a veteran volunteer who reaches out to the community, who makes sure there's space in that library for veterans to meet with others to help fill out their benefits. When they started that service, a veteran came in who said he'd been trying for 20 years to get his benefits. And in an hour, the staff at that library helped him do that. So you can be an intermediary. You can provide a space, as many of the public libraries in California do, but you can customize that. And some of the other recommendations we're hearing is that veteran needs change over their lifetime. And so the recent veterans are those who are interested in job seeking. And I'm interested in also continuing this study by looking at the many people who are already in our field who are veterans. So we also interviewed two current students who are veterans to just ask them, what was the presence of a library during your service? And how did you happen to find us? How did you happen to find a school of information? What are your desires? So there, you know, and we're seeing thoughts too of the veterans that, you know, their motivations to serve extend beyond their service time. That is, they want to engage in work that helps their fellow veterans. They want to learn how to start nonprofits. They want to learn how to return what they are seeing and what they've experienced to their colleagues. One of the partners, we have two partners with this project. One is Dr. Wendy Peters, Native Hawaiian, who is a veteran who served in the military, and her husband retired military, and she has a strong history, and her dissertation was on the wounded heart and trauma. And so she's been a good person to share the readings with and to read over her own work. And her other partner in this project has been Mary Judd, the executive director of Songwriting with Soldiers. And the creative director of Songwriting with Soldiers and the person who founded it is an Austin area musician and songwriter named Darden Smith. In fact, Darden was just up in Nashville earlier this week or last week recording, recording an album, but making a recording of songs co-written by soldiers at some of their Songwriting with Soldiers retreats. So there are lots of, I think in some ways there are many, many services for veterans. How can the library connect with partner organizations in the community while still being a library, because we know we have the resources and the skills to help? And so I'm very interested in continuing to watch this idea. If you want to hear more, we have a panel at the 2016 Public Library Association conference in Denver, and other great people on the panel who have a reputation for starting services for veterans. And then I have colleagues at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland, and we're interested in looking at the veterans' experience there. And I also have some friends in the UK who are veterans. And so it's not a topic that's slipping off of my work plate, but it's required, I think, a lot of thinking. And it's very worthy of continuing examination.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's especially the older veterans maybe that don't have the computer savvy that now, as you were talking about, that all those benefits, that's all online now. You can't, there's no more paper forms. They have to fill it out on online. So they really need somebody a lot of times to help them out. So that's great. You're also serving on the Library of Congress Literacy Awards.
Yes.
Can you talk about that? That sounds exciting.
Oh, that's a wonderful experience and wonderful opportunity. And through the financial support of Mr. David Rubenstein in Washington, D.C., the Library of Congress has some funding for initially a set number of years, to recognize the work, not only in our country, but internationally, that is being done in the area of literacy. And there is a small group of people who serve on this board or advisory board in many ways that where we actually make the recommendations to the Librarian of Congress of the people we think and or organizations we think should be recognized through, by an award. So we just finished the third round of recognition. There was a small reception in D.C. in the end of October, at the end of October, for what they call the best practices. Now, not everyone can get an award, but there are many cases around the world of wonderful examples that could serve as models for others. The Library of Congress creates a little document that identifies some of these best practices, and those acknowledged individuals or groups were recognized in a reception in October this spring. In February, there'll be a reception and an event honoring the recipients of this year's three awards. I've been on the panel or the subgroup of that advisory group to select and make recommendations of the for the international awards. So we receive application. The application process is actually pretty streamlined. I've served on the, on committees for determining grant recipients for IMLS and for the Department of Commerce. And then earlier when the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation had the Access to Learning Award, and so people sometimes have to apply to huge documents and a huge application process. This is not very detailed. It's just a couple page report answering a few questions with a couple support letters, though people often add supplementary material. But it's to reward what has been done. That is the main thing. Instead of if someone were to say, this is what we plan to do, that's a good idea, but tell us what you've done. And so it's great to work on this committee. You meet people I would have never met otherwise. I might have heard of them. We do have a couple authors on the committee. David Baldacci, who's a wonderful committee member. We have people who, again, represent the literacy community. And I talk a lot about the place of native language literacy, and I would love to be able to recognize the great work that's being done within tribal communities on language recovery, language revitalization. And so we need to get the word out, and we throughout the year sort of remind people there is this award, there is this recognition, and there is funding. And besides, you get to meet other great people at this meeting. So we hope the awards continue. They're wonderful, and it's in line with not only the mission of the Library of Congress, but within all these organizations, and certainly the action area within our field of librarianship.
Well, hopefully by the time you guys are ready to give out the awards, there'll actually be a Librarian of Congress to give them out. So yeah. I know David Mao is working as the acting librarian right now. But
whoever is there, well, they're welcome and past and present. And, in fact, the meeting and is open when they have the presentations. It is an open event at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., and they often have an author speak, and so it's in line with the services the Library of Congress provides, such as the National Book Festival, too.
And then I wanted to ask about, also, you mentioned before we recorded about a couple of books that you're working on that you're co-editing with some people. One of them is called Indigenous Notions of Ownership of Libraries, Archives, and Museums, and the other is a collection of papers from the European Conference on Information Literacy. Can you talk about how you got to be involved with those and what those are about?
Yeah, thank you. Well, the edited volume on Indigenous Notions is going to be published by IFLA. And actually, the manuscript goes back to IFLA by the end of this month, just in a couple of weeks. I've been fortunate to be working with two great co-editors. And the invitation, it actually came as an invitation to me from an IFLA book editor. And and it was the initial invitation was to edit a book on legal matters. And I said, you know, that's not me. I can I have ideas, but I don't have the law preparation. I said, I'll recruit someone, though. I will advertise it broadly and we'll find someone who would be best suited for this. And a librarian, a native librarian who is at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, said she would love to do, you know, to edit this book, but she would only do it if I co-edited with her. And I said, I would only do it if one of my students could work with us too. So we've been a triad.
Camille Collison. Works out well.
Yeah, Camille Collison at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, and Gretchen Lachemiant, one of our now graduated students. And we have 20 wonderful chapters contributed by people from around the world, and wonderful stories of what is the notion of Indigenous ways and access to Indigenous knowledge in Canada, in Aotearoa, that's New Zealand, or Hawaii, or the Philippines, or Taiwan, with case examples. I wrote the initial chapter and kind of answering the general question, who is Indigenous, or providing some answers, because it will be in people's minds as they start this read. And then one of my colleagues, Kieran Trace, and I have another chapter later on where we summarize what we learned through a survey we conducted of library school faculty preparing students in librarianship and archives on their how they felt prepared and knowledgeable about Indigenous ways and how students felt prepared about Indigenous ways. So we have that chapter, but it'll be a great book, and Gretchen's going to send it to our editor in a couple of weeks. They're doing the final editing of the last couple chapters. I edited 11 of the 20 and then said, Gretchen and Camille, you know, step on in and the last 9 chapters, if you can do the editing, but ask me any questions. We of course, we had over 43-hour conference calls on the book, but then you have to do the mechanical, you know, checking the direct quotes and the bibliographies, that sort of thing. So that's where that is. The other edited volume, I think it's published by Springer, and I believe it may be published as early as January next month. And this is really a volume of proceedings of the best papers delivered at the recent European Conference on Information Literacy, an event that just took place for the 3rd time in Tallinn, Estonia, in October. And I had not heard about ESA until a year ago, August, when I was at an IFLA satellite meeting on information literacy in Limerick, Ireland. And people were asking me, are you going to ESO? I go, no, tell me more about ESO. So that was for its 2nd meeting. So I was fortunate to be invited to serve on the editorial board. They have 4 people who are on the editorial board, and one person was unable to do the work. And so last spring, I was asked to serve, and by Diane Mizrachi, who has completed her dissertation on the area of in information literacy and the preference of students for print or e-material, e-books. So very interesting. And so I said, sure, I'll be happy to serve on the editorial board. What's the work and when does it happen? And so it was a lot of work in editing. About each of us edited about 70 conference abstracts. And then I thought the work was done. They said, no, we're going to get the full conference papers of the best papers. And so those came. And then each of us edited about 2,000 word or so papers. And those are going to be published. So I think, you know, I teach a class also, a graduate class on library instruction, information literacy. And I think a lot of excitement in that field is international. And so you have ESO, you have LILAC, which is the UK's CILIP, their equivalent to ALA's section on information literacy. There's even an information literacy conference in Iceland in June. So there is a strong community that's very research-based, that crosses into this is what we need to learn, but really stepping up to address needs for learning broadly defined. And so it's an exciting community. I really invite our field and those interested in instruction to check out ESO, particularly. Next year, the conference will be in Prague. It's a very well-run conference. And I hope to be able to continue on the editorial board, and I'll see if I am, if my invitation stands, because I did learn quite a bit, and I have great content to bring back to my students, including a possible service learning experience for the students in spring 2016.
Yeah, those both sound great. the last question I wanted to ask was sort of a hypothetical one, that if University of Texas said to you, you can only teach one class a semester from now on, but it can be any class that you choose, what class would you pick?
Oh, gosh.
I don't know if that's like picking your favorite child or something.
Yeah. In some ways, it's happened where some of my classes have kind of moved off. Again, our enrollment is down, so all the enrollment in elective classes goes down. And if you're not teaching a coding class, which we don't actually offer, but we have tried various versions, and there's, you know, that opportunity within courses, then, you know, the little wave of interest goes in different directions. For many years, it would have been the public libraries class, but as of this fall, I'm no longer teaching that. That was taken off the schedule. In some ways, it's a basic reference class. But this fall, I was the guest in one of my colleagues' classes, Kieran Trace's Archival Enterprise 1 class. And a request came from the students after our meeting that whether I'd consider teaching a class on, for our program, on Indigenous ways. So I would just use that phrase before a full title comes out. And I have taught a class a couple times that focused more on library services for Indigenous peoples. But I think something related to that Indigenous notions of access and learning and service, I think, would be great. And in part, this came because we had an intense discussion in Kieran's class about Truth and Reconciliation Commission work in Canada and the place for archivists and information specialists in working with sensitive material, tribally connected material, and respect and handling of access issues. So I think that would be a big discussion class. I'm kind of open. I usually teach 4 different classes a year, and I'm currently the graduate advisor, so I am serving my end of my 2 years in that term, so I get 1 course reduction. But I'm teaching 3 different classes this year. I taught basic reference in the core information and social cultural context this fall. In the spring, it's library instruction. And and always open to the University of Hawaii Manoa is asking me again, but, you know, and maybe even I mentioned to Marianne Hansen at Montana State University, if there was a subsequent grant that I could be, you know, of assistance to, might be to teach our first online class here, but on Indigenous ways, that we would open to students across LAS programs and to see how that works. And I pass that by our dean, and he was open to that possibility as too, especially if it came initially through grant funding. So sort of an answer to your question, but not quite. Maybe it's advisory I should teach. I did get to teach a class on digital, creating digital space for popular music, and focused on the life and career and impact of one of my favorite musicians. I taught that not this fall, but the last 2 falls, and it'd be wonderful to have that again. And this time it would be honoring the legacy of that musician, Ian or Mac McLagan.
Yeah, I was going to ask who the musician was.
Yeah, he was a very well-known and loved musician who passed away the day after class last fall. And just wonderful guy. But more stories about Mac than ever. And so his presence is still very well, very much felt here. His first group was the Small Faces. And then when Steve Marriott left and Rod Stewart joined their group, it became the Faces. And he lived in Austin for the last 20 years of his life.
Right. Well, Laureen, if anybody wanted to follow up with you, how could they get in touch with you?
Oh, email. They can send me email. Unless you're a Facebook friend already. But... It's loreen@iSchool.utexas.edu. Easy to find. If you can't remember that or if you can't spell my name, just look at the School of Information, University of Texas at Austin, and the directory of faculty is there.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate it.
Which, that's Anishinaabe Mwen for thank you. So, Chi Magwitch, thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye. If you'd like to learn more about the show or listen to past episodes, you can visit circulatingideas.com or follow us on Twitter @CircIdeas. We're also on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com, or you can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can drop us a line at mail@circulatingideas.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating the ideas.